It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, isolation and uncertainty from the pandemic have had a big impact on Wisconsinites who are dealing with drug abuse disorders. A Wisconsin health professional joins the show to talk about the problem and possible solutions. First, House Democrats passed the outline for a $3.5 trillion budget package yesterday. The party line vote came after days of debate between moderate Democrats and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The moderates wanted a separate bipartisan infrastructure deal to get a vote first. Pelosi rejected that request, but did commit to voting on the bipartisan package by the end of September. It's the Week in Washington. We'll talk about the latest on infrastructure, plus the latest news on Afghanistan. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the bipartisan so-called hard infrastructure package pass, the roads and bridges kind of stuff, and or the Democrats' so-called human infrastructure package, adding to child care funding and a bunch of other stuff? Does this make a difference in your life? Is there spending needed, you think, where you live? Are you hoping something gets passed here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Mascaro is Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, talk about infrastructure. There have been a lot of roadblocks along the way for some kind of infrastructure package. Can you give us what happened here among House Democrats that threatened to derail this thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And the way you set it up is pretty accurate about the way things are going here. You know, the Senate last month passed this what we call slimmer bipartisan public works plan. You know, by slimmer, it's a $1 trillion package. So still very substantial package of, you know, roads, highways, broadband. What the House is moving over here is sort of the blueprint for a much broader infrastructure plan. And as you mentioned at the outset, it's sort of what the Biden administration is calling the human infrastructure. So it includes some of the more traditional infrastructure that folks might be familiar with, but takes it in sort of a different direction. We're talking child care centers, money for universal pre-kindergarten for all children, some investments in home health care and services for older Americans, and then a broad expansion of Medicare and some of these other health and social service programs, along with a lot of green energy and sort of infrastructure that will help combat climate change. Okay, it's a very big order. Mm-hmm. It's a package that Democrats are going to have to pass on their own because Republicans look at this and say, you know, thanks, but no thanks. This is big government spending they don't want anything to do with. And so Congress is trying to muscle this through the Democratic leaders of the House and Senate through this special process that allows them to pass measures on just a simple majority. That means just their side of the aisle. And so what that means, though, is that the Democrats have to be fully on board. And in the Democratic caucus in both the House and Senate, that also is a very tall order because you have, you know, the progressive wing of the caucus represented by folks like Bernie Sanders and, you know, the more conservatives, folks like Joe Manchin and these other senators, same as in the House. And they have just a few votes to spare. Their majority is just very, very narrow, about a 3-vote margin. And so they really, Speaker Nancy Pelosi must keep everyone on board. And so as they were setting out this week to pass this blueprint, they had objections, and a core group of centrist Democrats said, look, we don't want to go forward with this big package unless we have some assurances that this slimmer package will also not get lost by on the wayside and have a chance to be voted on too. It's very sort of in the weeds procedure mm-hmm. and maybe strategy. But for the centrists, this was important for them because they feel that this slimmer package is sort of what's doable. And while they're not opposed to the bigger package necessarily, they don't want to see the sort of perfect be the enemy of the good, as you might say. They want to make sure this slimmer package is able to get through. So, you know, through their objections, they were able to sort of bring the House to a standstill this week. The lawmakers came back Monday night for what was supposed to be sort of a quick session. And gosh, everything just, you know, came to a sort of topsy-turvy halt. There were lots of closed-door meetings, sort of shuttled diplomacy here on Capitol Hill between the leaders and the lawmakers, having private sessions, trying to iron this out. And in the end, you know, people always say you don't vote against, you don't bargain against Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She did get this over the finish line yesterday on a just straight party line vote, got this blueprint over the finish line. They passed it in the House. Again, this is just a very, very first step. It now sort of sets the blueprint for this big package. It's a $3.5 trillion package. And now the committees are hard at work in the Congress putting together the details of that proposal, what it's going to look like, where the money would go, which agencies would get what. Lots more arguing to go for. And that'll all come back again in fall in a few more weeks as they start sort of really debating the guts of this proposal. I know it's so confusing, sure, probably, to hear all that, a lot of procedure, but that's a little bit of where we're at right now. And I hope that helps explain it for folks.
And Lisa, with both of these packages now, what is the anticipated timeline for, again, knowing that there could be a lot more obstacles between now and then, what is the goal now for Democrats to get both of these done?
Perfect question. Right. So the goal is to have both of these packages passed by October 1st in the House. And Senate hasn't quite said that. But the House has said that as part of this agreement that Speaker Pelosi reached with the moderates this week, the centrists. She agreed to have a vote on the slimmer package a few days before that. So September 27th will be the deadline to vote on this $1 trillion package. And by mid-September, September 15th or so, we will start seeing the draft legislation of what this bigger package will look like. So just to back up then, you know, the Congress is away now for a few weeks. They'll be back after the Labor Day recess, and we'll start having some hearings in the committees, some discussions of the draft legislation. We'll likely, for that big $3.5 trillion package, we'll likely see a vote on this slimmer $1 trillion package by the end of the month. There's some other business that Congress has to attend to by the September 30th, which is the annual deadline to fund the government and keep the government running. You might remember these government shutdown battles from days past. They've got to agree to fund the government. And then, you know, right around the corner, October 1st or sometime thereafter, we should start seeing them really debating and starting to potentially vote on this bigger package. It's an enormous undertaking. Democrats, President Biden, this is one of his top domestic priorities. They are comparing it to sort of the kind of federal expenditure that happened, you know, under Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal or the Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. It is something on that level. And you know, these are big lifts in Congress at a time when Congress is really polarized. So we'll see. We'll see how far they can get.
Talking to Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press. She's with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in Washington, including the infrastructure plans advancing, not a done deal yet. You can join in with your hopes and fears about these spending plans and what you've heard about them at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also, we'll talk about the ongoing evacuations in Afghanistan and Kabul in particular. August 31st, the goal for President Biden. Do you think President Biden keep evacuations going past that date if need be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. Lisa Mascaro stays with us from the Associated Press. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1, 2, 3, 4. Turning now to evacuations from Kabul, the U.S. withdrawal of troops there. You can join in with your thoughts or questions on that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to President Biden. He said yesterday the U.S. is on pace to wrap up evacuations by the August 31st deadline. Here's some of what he had to say from the White House.
The sooner we can finish, the better. Each day of operations brings added risk to our troops. But the completion by August 31st depends upon the Taliban continuing to cooperate and allow access to the airport for those who were transporting out, and no disruptions to our operations.
This evacuation, Lisa, involves U.S. citizens there, Afghans who have special immigrant visas, and others at risk there. Can you talk about why Biden is focused on this August 31st deadline?
Right. So this is just such a wrenching situation there is in Afghanistan. I'm sure people have been seeing the videos and images coming out of people lined up at the airport. You know, this is the drawdown time that he set. U.S. officials are in consultation with, frankly, the Taliban there to secure the airport and get those folks out. This is part of the drawdown that has been underway in sort of bringing a close to this 20-year war in Afghanistan. And, you know, it's certainly raised a lot of concerns on all sides. It's the one issue we were just talking here that, you know, is really... Congress doesn't unite on many issues, but you see members, Republicans and Democrats, just really concerned about this situation and doing what they can to, help the government get Americans and those who helped the U.S. government there out of the country by the deadline. There's a grave concern that not everyone will be able to leave. By the deadline, which is just next week, August 31st, Secretary Blinken just had a news conference here in Washington where he was discussing how many folks are remaining, American citizens are remaining. He said some 1,500 Americans may be awaiting evacuation. We have a story out from the AP on that right now, just sort of talking about how many more could be airlifted. It is a very difficult situation there. I don't think we've heard the end of this thing from Congress or the president of sort of how this is going to go.
What kind of criticism are you hearing from members of Congress? So when it comes to the Biden administration's handling of the withdrawal from Afghanistan?
Oh, goodness. It's a little bit of all of the above. You know, there are those that say that the sort of process for withdrawing the troops and then trying to get the Americans out was not done in the right order. There are others who just say it should have been more well thought out. There is a sense from both parties of that there is, fatigue of being in Afghanistan and the, billions of dollars that have been spent and number of troops that have been sent over there over the past 20 years. But, how to withdraw has always been just a very complicated situation because, the U.S. government is concerned about, turning over the country in a way that leads it to, foster the kinds of problems that led to the 9/11 attacks here in 2001, with the extremist groups. That said, there's sort of no easy out here. And, I think you see Democrats questioning, wanting to support Biden, but also questioning the way he has executed this plan. And of course, Republicans doing the same, even though they too, as we saw under President Trump, wanted to sort of wind down operations there and sort of focus, back at home on the issues here in this country, the United States, or in other parts of the world. A lot of interest looking now at China and Russia and some of the other parts of the world where the U.S. needs to sort of focus its attention. So there's just a lot of sort of criticism and concern across the board. And then yet at the same time, folks, working very hard, it seems, trying to do what they can to sort of improve the situation. We're hearing from a number of lawmakers' offices that are, working, trying to help people, you know, who may have loved ones or people they know in Afghanistan that they're trying to secure their evacuation.
And you focus on Congress in your reporting. There's controversy about two members of Congress who made a previously unannounced trip to Kabul. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, that's right. One of my colleagues here at the AP broke that story last night. Two congressmen, a Democrat and a Republican, again, so sort of symbolic of this across the aisle partnership of concern over this issue. It's Congressman Seth Moulton from Massachusetts and Peter Mayer from Michigan is the Republican. They're both for military men. Congressman Moulton's a Marine who served multiple tours in Iraq at the sort of onset of the after the 9/11 in the war in Iraq, and Congressman Mayer, who had served in the reserves, and then also returned or went to Afghanistan as part of a non-governmental organization that was doing relief work over there, sort of in the subsequent years, sort of the middle years of the war. And they both had grave concerns when they learned about the withdrawal and the massing of Americans and allies at the Kabul airport trying to get out. And they took a secret trip to the to Kabul this week to investigate the situation, see what they could do. They said they were, they felt they needed to go and see and do oversight. They issued a statement last night talking about why they took this trip. But it raised grave concerns on the part of U.S. officials here in Washington, the Pentagon, elsewhere, because the situation is so dangerous in Afghanistan right now. And the officials here were so concerned that the lawmakers' visit was sort of a diversion and, taxing on the resources. Usually when members of Congress, go to a foreign country, the State Department, the Pentagon, the U.S. government here is well aware and is sort of involved in some of that planning and assuring their safety. And the fact that these two lawmakers went, they've received a lot of criticism and rebuke for going. Speaker Pelosi said today it was not a good idea. The Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, also said he would not encourage anyone else to be doing this. This is not what lawmakers should be doing. That said, lawmakers have also said there's just a lot of frustration and people don't feel that they could sort of sit idly by and watch this situation. So, it is a concern and a problem that these lawmakers went. Yet there's also some acknowledgement that there is a grave frustration and concern on the part of the lawmakers that more needs to be done to ensure the safe passage of Americans and allies in Afghanistan.
Talking to Lisa Mascaro, chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. I want to take a couple of minutes, Lisa, to look at the latest from the Biden administration and Congress on COVID-19. The Delta variant, of course, creating hotspots around the country. Vaccination numbers, after lagging for a while, seem to be going up. What are we hearing from the federal government about the latest efforts to encourage more people to get vaccinated?
Yeah, that's right. You're seeing that, again, another sort of rare bipartisan moment here where you have really seen, some Republican governors stepping up and trying to encourage residents in their states who have not yet been vaccinated to get the vaccine. You're seeing business step in. We saw Delta Airlines today. There was a report out, requiring vaccines for employees or they face a fine. And the government, of course, enlisting PSA, public service announcements, and other methods to encourage people to get the vaccine. What we know is that most of the hospitalizations and deaths being reported right now are among the unvaccinated. And while there are breakthrough cases of COVID, especially with this Delta variant, for those who have been vaccinated, those people are not generally getting as sick. Here in Congress, we've had three senators last week announce that they had breakthrough cases of COVID. They've all been vaccinated, but they tested positive. But, you know, so far, you know, there people are able to recover and not having as serious a complications as those who are unvaccinated. This is such a challenge right now because at the same time, the government is opening the door to the need for booster shots. And so those who have already been vaccinated are going to need to be thinking about getting their booster shot. And, you know, that's not open for everybody right now, but, you know, there is increasing movement towards that. And so there's just going to be sort of this, you know, rolling need to get people, you know, protected, inoculated against this virus. And, you know, there's still a lot of resistance. We see it in hotspots across the country. And it's an ongoing challenge, obviously.
And then just in our last minute or so, Lisa, what story do you have your eye on next now with Congress closed for business for a little bit?
Oh, that's a really good question. You know, we're sort of catching our breath here. But I will say, I think the ongoing debate over this budget and whether these infrastructure expenditures, investments are able to clear Congress, you know, will be the big thing this fall that we will have to be just monitoring and trying to see what, you know, I'm curious what your listeners will be saying about that. I'm curious what Americans, you know, whether they will support this. Right now, some of the polling shows people are interested in what Biden is proposing as part of this big, you know, build back agenda that he has, rebuilding America. But, you know, what exactly this big package will look like in the end, and can the Congress, you know, see it to get it over to the president's desk for a signature? You know, those are all big moving targets for us.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Okay, Rob, thanks so much for having me.
That's Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press, with us today for our weekly look at the top stories in national news. Coming up, a new report finds a link between overdose deaths in Wisconsin and the pandemic. A substance abuse expert joins us with a look at the best ways to prevent and treat addiction. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, anxiety can be a big problem in normal times, and the last year has given people even more to be anxious about. The good news, there are ways to cope with it. Meet the author of the new book, Unwinding Anxiety. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a new report from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services finds a strong connection between the COVID-19 pandemic and a larger-than-expected increase in opioid overdose incidents. Suspected opioid overdose incidents increased early on in the pandemic from March to about August of last year, according to data, before decreasing again. And it looks like the numbers could be on the rise again this year, but that information is still coming in. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone in your life been dealing with substance abuse issues throughout the pandemic? What's that experience been like? Have there been additional challenges? What do you think others can do to help those dealing with addiction? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Sheila Weichs is Director of Substance Abuse Services for Family Health Center at Marshfield Clinic Health System. Sheila, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Well, the pandemic disrupted our lives in a number of ways. What were some of the key ways, as you see it, that that it added extra challenges to treating substance abuse in Wisconsin?
Well, where our services are is we serve rural Wisconsin, particularly central and north areas. And there were multiple impacts. Certainly, when we needed to go into the shutdown, the lockdown due to the pandemic, there were multiple people who were not able to work There were, of course, children not able to go to school, so they were attempting to homeschool. There was just all of the anxiety about what was going to happen next. It was a very, very frightening time. At the same time that things were shutting down, so contacts and services that people might have been using prior to that, like coming to counseling, going to recovery groups, much of that shut down as well. So people were left very isolated in a very stressful time without access to some of the supports they would have ordinarily used. As a result, there was a real increase in use for people who perhaps had issues already. But then we also saw people who maybe had just used socially, whether it's alcohol or other substances, that they turned to using more as part of their coping, whether it was because they weren't going to work, so you could have alcohol every day or use opioids, whatever it was. But we just saw all kinds of things that ordinarily were protective factors just fall away under the pandemic. So it was a very, very difficult time for people.
You mentioned the unique challenges in rural Wisconsin, and I've talked to people over the years about big gaps in available in-person services. How do you work to try to bridge that in normal times or during a pandemic?
Well, in normal times, you have the transportation issues always. We have three clinics in the service area that I talked about, and between clinics, it's a solid two-hour trip. So many of the people that we serve may drive an hour, 45 minutes or an hour one way to get to an appointment. So in a regular year, that's a challenge. When you add the pandemic and we can't see people in person, well, of course, the answer in many areas was to go to telehealth. The challenge in rural Wisconsin is there's not enough internet broadband access for people to do telehealth. The best we could do for many of the people we served were telephone calls. And it was better than not having any contact. But I can tell you, while it's still a contact, it's not the same as being able to see a person's face, be able to read what's going on with them, or even better, to be in person. So that's a major challenge when you can't do anything but a telephone call. And some of our people, I'll be very honest, they have trouble getting enough reception to not have calls drop. So rural Wisconsin has some major challenges in trying to deliver services that are not in person.
As you mentioned, this story is about a number of different substances that people are abusing, from alcohol to illegal drugs. I mentioned those statistics about overdoses in particular with various kinds of opioids. What are you seeing with that issue in particular in your practice and around the state?
We certainly have seen overdoses increase. Again, because we're in rural areas, you aren't necessarily seeing the larger numbers that you see in urban areas, but the number of them occurring, it's increased. The other piece that happens is we've seen so many people using more than one substance. So if you're using opioids, but then you add alcohol to it, you've got an additive effect for a person shutting down and stopping breathing. And we've seen so many people adding alcohol or other substances to what they already use. So there was just a major additive effect. We routinely distribute Narcan to the people that we serve. We do know that that has had some impact, but yeah, overdoses definitely up. And then for whatever reason, there seemed to be no interruption in the delivery of drugs. Fentanyl is very much present, heroin is present, we're seeing cocaine. So while all kinds of other things were interrupted, drug delivery was not. That continued.
We're talking to Sheila Weix, substance abuse expert for Marshfield Clinic Health System, talking about substance abuse during the pandemic, the challenges in getting treatment, the stress that might be adding to the problem for a lot of people. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Shea is with us in Madison. Shea, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I wanted to share an experience. I have a child who struggles with substance abuse and mental health. And unfortunately, we've had to go to the ER since COVID started. One of the reasons to go to the ER is to have a mental health evaluation to be admitted to inpatient, which is really the only way to get into inpatient. And we just had an experience where we went to the ER, was pushed out in an hour because the ER was totally filled with other needs. I'm guessing a lot of them were COVID. But basically, the mental health needs were not being able to be addressed because of the way the system is set up. And the system is focusing right now on a lot of COVID needs, so that then the mental health piece was missed completely. Another piece to that, I think, played into it, too, is that, you know, everyone's really busy. And unfortunately, there was law enforcement involved, and law enforcement seems to precede any mental health evaluation. So a mental health evaluation was missed, or the social worker didn't do it because the decision was there's going to be, criminal justice involved. So it's like a system breakdown, and it's struggling more, I think, because of COVID and those needs around ER and having ER is the only way to get admitted to inpatient.
Wow. Shea, thank you so much for sharing your experience. Good luck to you and your daughter, your family as a whole. Shea brought up a lot of interesting points. First of all, I hadn't even thought of that. Emergency rooms around the country now, again, getting crowded with COVID patients. That might be making it harder for someone in Shea's daughter's situation to access needed emergency services related to substance abuse and mental health.
Absolutely. The systems are very stretched. And as COVID increases, as we've been seeing, and certainly as you watch the news, it applies to any number of other non-COVID situations. Mental health, absolutely, but also heart attacks and strokes and any number of other things. The system is very, very stressed at this point. And of course, the numbers are going up for infections with the variant. So whatever one can do, and you can't always do something, but whatever one can do to have a plan or contact that will allow any other route can be helpful. And I have no idea if that's even a possibility for you. But that would be a consideration because you are right. You are likely to have the same experience for the next while if that is your only route in.
And Sheila, it occurs to me, if the first mental health evaluation, if the first step to getting treatment is having to go to an emergency room, I don't know, that doesn't seem like a very good system. Do we need more access to early interventions before you have this crisis that leads to the emergency room?
Well, my practice is in substance use disorder. I have some background in mental health. I don't present as expert in that. But what I can tell you is that each county has some level of services. So I would certainly check to see what is available through your county. And again, perhaps you've been down that path. I don't have enough awareness to know, but that is certainly another route to at least crisis plans and a method to get the needs met that may not involve the emergency room. Just a thought that may help.
And then Shea also mentioned law enforcement. And here I want to focus specifically on the substance abuse angle. Obviously, there's a law enforcement role. What do you see as the best way of cooperating between law enforcement when it comes to substance abuse issues and treatment?
It really depends on when the interaction is happening. Certainly, if someone is in the midst of a crime involving alcohol or drugs, that's a whole different spot than when law enforcement has awareness of someone who clearly has a substance use disorder and they're trying to find assistance for them. We have several law enforcement entities that do work to help people get into treatment to prevent further arrests. Some of it is truly just on a shoestring with volunteers. They've connected with some local faith organizations. And if a person in the community says, I want help, there are law enforcement folks that says, we are here to help you. And they will connect them with things. They'll give them a ride. I mean, there's various things. Remember, this is rural Wisconsin. So the communities have long needed to depend on one another, people within the community. So several of those have come together. We have another law enforcement person who has a recovery coach he works with very closely. And they have people turning over their drugs, seeking to get into recovery, looking to connect with things. So there's multiple ways that if it's not in the middle of a commission of a crime, that law enforcement can be exceedingly helpful. And it's not a matter of it becoming more criminal charges, because we also recognize that can be a very fast path to things just getting worse and worse. If there's continued charges, continued being jailed, not being able to afford fines, et cetera. So the role can be very, very different depending on the approach that a particular agency or a particular officer is opting to use.
We're talking to Sheila Weix, Director of Substance Abuse Services for the Family Health Center at Marshfield Clinic Health System. We are talking about substance abuse during the pandemic, unique challenges in getting people to treatment, and added stress maybe leading to more substance abuse problems. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been part of your life over the last year? If you're willing, could you share your experience yourself with a family member or someone who provides treatment yourself? Or if you're in law enforcement, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Sheila Weix, Director of Substance Abuse Services for the Family Health Center at Marshfield Clinic Health System. We're talking about addiction and substance abuse during the pandemic. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences. What, have you had trouble finding treatment for yourself or a loved one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Peter's with us from the Village of Summers. Peter, hello.
Hi there. Personal level, I just want to say that in the past 16 months, I have lost 7 friends to opioid overdoses. And the murky question that I'm hoping that that can be answered here is, when a person overdoses, how is it determined if the underlying cause of their overdose was maybe a suicide attempt? And do the numbers really correlate? And how is that determined? Because just on a personal level, and I realize this is anecdotal, but those of us who have been left behind were wondering, yes, so-and-so was suffering depression, and was this a suicide? And I'm just wondering how that determination is made when looking at these numbers.
Peter, I'm sorry for all of that loss in your life. Thank you for sharing that with us. Sheila, this is something determined by coroners and medical examiners, but can you talk about that overlap, as he's talking about, between depression, isolation, substance abuse, and the potential for overdose?
Absolutely. And Peter, I'm so sorry for your loss. That is so difficult. And to have multiple losses that way is a tremendous challenge. What I can tell you is that there are some studies where they've looked at exactly that question. And in some studies, they've said as high as at least 25% of what has been labeled overdose is actually a suicide. Depression is so rampant. Plus, I want you to think about when someone is in the middle of their substance use disorder and really just using and all of the losses, because let's face it, this is a disease that takes everything eventually, that when that's going on, it is really possible to become hopeless. And hopelessness is what is behind a lot of suicides. If you cannot see that there is any future or there's any way out, suicide becomes a viable option for some people at that point. So one of the things that I heard you say in that, and you are absolutely correct, oftentimes substance use disorders are not occurring by themselves. There are what we call co-occurring disorders. Depression is a major one. Anxiety disorders are very, very frequent. When you have those and they're not treated, sometimes part of what people are using is to deal with that. To try with symptoms. PTSD is often present because so many of the people who have substance use disorders also have a positive history of trauma from various aspects of their life. So all of that comes together. So when you think about that, there's a couple of thoughts that come to mind. One is that isolation is a key piece of this, and the pandemic has been really terrible for that. People have been much more isolated. So things like, even though it's a text or an email, that reaching out or call, that reaching out to connect, that's a really important part. Will it absolutely guarantee that someone won't overdose? Of course not. But it may give somebody that contact that day that makes a difference. I think other things, and there is information available online and things around recognizing potential signs of depression or suicide in a friend or a colleague or a family member that would alert you to want to do something more. I apologize, I don't have those resources, but if you would just do a search for that, I think you can find some resources. But I believe that your question is right on target. Mm-hmm. And as Rob said, it's determined by coroners, but there are so many circumstances. And I have to say, when you have somebody, for instance, who's been using opioids for a long time, and where you find them is they've taken everything they've got, that chances are that was a suicide. Because if they've been using for a while and they don't suddenly have fentanyl or something else in their supply, so they're used to what they take, people know what they usually take. So if you suddenly take everything, yeah, you're probably looking at an overdose.
Peter.
Or an intended suicide.
Peter, so thanks a lot for the call. Sense? Definitely. And one resource, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. And Sheila, I understand a big focus, or one of the focuses of the treatment you offer, is harm reduction. And I think people might think of you're either using substances or you're not. Can you talk about that principle, that idea of harm reduction?
Yes, yes. So sometimes what happens is someone will present to us, because we do medication-assisted treatment, so we provide Suboxone or Vivitrol. And a person will present to us, and we will get them going on the Suboxone, which really goes a long way to help stabilize them with their opioids. But they may also be using methamphetamine and some alcohol, and maybe if you're on some cocaine and some marijuana. We will work on that. It isn't a matter of, oh, now you're on the medication, everything in your urine has to disappear. We know it doesn't work like that. So we continue to work on those things, and we expect them to go away over time and that the person's working hard on recovery. But a lot of it's harm reduction. It's one of the reasons that every person that sees us gets a prescription for Narcan. And we talk to them about, please be sure your family, your friends know about this. We have had situations where that dose of Narcan from us was administered to somebody and it saved a life. You know, that's harm reduction, because you can't possibly help somebody to recover if they're no longer breathing. So yeah, harm reduction, you do things like that. Needle exchanges make sense. Anything that can help the person keep going until they're ready to do something more for recovery. That's what the harm reduction is about.
And just in our last few moments, Sheila, a bright side here is it seems like there are a lot of proven treatments. There's a lot in our toolkit, right?
Absolutely. Medication-assisted treatment with opioids has made a huge difference. And for anyone who's started on it, within 2 weeks of starting, the person is able to think better. Their life becomes less chaotic, and then they can begin to work on recovery. So that's a very positive thing. There are a number of approaches to the actual treatment that can make a difference. There are Vivitrol injections, which can support a number of people. That's naltrexone. So yeah, there are a number of things that can help, absolutely. And again, as long as a person draws breath, they're capable of recovery. There's no such thing as the person's had X number of treatments, so they can't have treatment anymore. Absolutely not. And people change over time. People can recover, and it makes a difference for everyone.
Sheila, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Sheila Wykes, Director of Substance Abuse Services for the Family Health Center at Marshfield Clinic Health System. She joined us today to talk about an increase in overdose and substance abuse incidents in Wisconsin during the pandemic and the kinds of treatment that are available out there. We've got a link to a recovery and mental health service finder in the state. You can find that right now at WPR.org/Central Time. Again, find resources at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a newspaper chain with lots of outlets here in Wisconsin is changing the way it covers crime. Find out what's in the works and why it's happening. And election workers at state and local levels have seen a lot of threats from the public since the November elections. We'll find out more. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. There's a lot of good stuff coming out of gardens and farmers markets these days, including peppers of all shapes and sizes. Not my garden patch. I have tried and failed in the past with bell peppers, though my wife has a plant in a pot on the front porch that's doing okay. Peppers will be the topic of our Food Friday conversation this week. And Central Time bell pepper fan Bill Martins is here for some hype. Hey, Bill.
Howdy.
Hey, now I understand you're like me. You've tried and failed with bell peppers. Did you plant them this year?
I did not do it last year because they didn't do well last year. I said, I'm not doing that again. I had two plants last year. They were orange bell peppers, and they never really took off. Mm-hmm. I think I got maybe four peppers from both plants, and they were all like 3 inches long.
Well, you did better than I did.
But they were just tiny, and I didn't have many. Really?
Yeah. I'm a pepper failure. But that said, you have kind of a pepper habit, if I'm not mistaken.
I eat a raw pepper with my lunch every day, just a red, a yellow, or orange one. Just cut it up, eat it raw, have that with my lunch every day. I've done that for years. It's really good.
And that reminds me of former Central Time producer Amanda Magnus, who would cut up and eat a bell pepper at our pitch meetings, and famously she'd like lick the knife after she did. It's kind of intimidating. Do you do that?
I have not done that.
I'm not that
committed.
You should start. Yeah, it's kind of threatening in a cool way. All right, peppers on Food Friday coming up this week. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.